Welcome to SQ Radio. This is Sherry Quinn.
And I'm Susie Montgomery.
Mad sounds in your ears make you feel all right.
We're taking the science out of SQ Radio on the program today and featuring art, cinematic art to be exact. The 2014 Sundance Film Festival starts January 16th, and we present filmmaker Sterling Harjo from Holdenville, Oklahoma. Harjo has gained critical and audience acclaim with his films across the world, and in 2006 he was the youngest and the first Native American recipient of the United States Artist Fellowship, which is supported by a consortium of major foundations. That year he also won the Creative Promise Award from Tribeca, all access for a script under the working title Before the Beast Returns. At age 23, Harjo was accepted into the Sundance Institute's Filmmakers Lab and developed his first film, Four Sheets to the Wind. His short film, Goodnight Irene, premiered at the 2005 Sundance Film Festival and was cited for special jury recognition at the Aspen Shorts Fest.
It's tough enough being an Indian these days, and now you've got this loss to deal with.
His second dramatic feature, Barking Water, premiered at the 2008 Sundance Film Festival, and he's back this year with a documentary feature titled This May Be the Last Time. Harjo revisits his grandfather's mysterious death and discovers how hymns play a role then and now in uniting families and communities. Harjo's personal journey starts in the songs of Oklahoma's native churches. To his astonishment, Harjo traces the influence of the songs to slavery in the deep American South and as far away as the Scottish Highlands. Sherry talked to Harjo this week at the Skywalker Ranch in Northern California, where he was putting the final touches on his film before it premieres at the Sundance Film Festival on Sunday, January 19th.
We're at the Skywalker Ranch. We're doing a sound mix on the film. Because it's a film about music, it's really exciting to have it mixed here. I mean, it just, you know, like the screening rooms are amazing. You get to hear your film like it probably will never be heard again. So it's a really beautiful place to be doing this.
Sterling Harjo belongs to the Muscogee Creek and Seminole tribes. He explains why his family lives in Oklahoma.
My tribes were moved to Oklahoma in the 1800s, forcibly removed on the Trail of Tears to what was then Indian Territory. And that's really what brought like most of my family there. And I grew up in a small town on the border of the Seminole and Creek Nation. I grew up in a town called Holdenville, and that's where all of my family's from, that area, Sissaqua, Oklahoma, and Holdenville. And, you know, I just grew up there. I grew up in a small town. It's about 5,000 people. The house that I grew up in is outside of that in the country. And I was always the, you know, I was always the kid that drew pictures, and I was a really good artist. And so I was always, that's what I from a young age, I knew that that's what I was going to do, something in art. My dad's a really good artist, but he never really pursued it. And so I feel like everyone in my life was always like, you know, encouraging me to not give up and to try to pursue art, because my dad had never, my dad didn't pursue it. And, you know, even that's what he would say to me, you know, I wish I would have always pursued art. You should really pursue it. And so that really just kind of, I think, defined me and put me on this path to make, you know, make my life about art and enter that world, I think, which eventually, once I got to college, led to filmmaking.
What was a typical day like for you growing up in a small town and community?
It was crazy. Like there wasn't really a typical day. I feel like, you know, it would depend on what I did that day. Because sometimes I would go to town, and I would go to I had a grandma that lived in town. I would go to her house, and we would, you know, I'd hook up with a friend and we would walk the town. I mean, we just walked around. It felt like Stand By Me or something. Whenever I look back on it, the movie Stand By Me, it's like we would just walk all over the town. And I actually, like, I have a 13-year-old daughter, and I took her for a walk the other day in the town because I live there now again. But I took her for a walk the other day, and there was no one walking around. And I was talking to her. I was like, man, when I was a kid, it was like we were all just like, you know, scouring the streets. And you know, I guess people are playing video games now or whatever. But so that was a typical day in town. We would just like walk all over that place and find something interesting to do, I guess, you know, like we were skateboarders or whatever. You know, like we would go to a friend's house, one of my friends that lived out on this dirt road, and, you know, a lot of us lived on dirt roads, but I would go to my, I remember going to my friend's house and we would walk down his dirt road and go sit on this bridge and just spend hours throwing a rock at a pole. Like that was just like entertainment, just sitting there for hours throwing a rock at a pole. And, you know, that was fun. And so, you know, we would do things like that. And, but then, you know, at other times I would be with my grandma who lives out in the country. She lives way out in the country. And so, with my cousins out there, and we would just run around and play. And those are really good memories, being out at my grandma's house.
In the beginning of the film, which you narrate, you say this small unknown town was the whole world to you. And can you explain how, for you, what it meant, the whole world?
I think as a native person, you people talk to you in this way that's like, they want to learn, they want to hear what it was like being native. If, you know, when, specifically when you're talking about songs, it's like, well, you know, what's it like? But growing up there, it's not like you don't look at yourself from the outside like other people do. That's just your life and that's your world. And so you experience it just like everyone else experiences life. So there's nothing mystical about it. There's nothing different about it. It's just the way it is. And, you know, it's not until you leave that you look back on it and realize how unique it was. And so I think that's what I mean by that. Like I left home and got to really look, you know, I lived in Oregon for a little bit in different places, and I got to really look back on where I come from, and I realized how unique it was. You know, as you grow up there, you just think everyone's like that. You know, it's like you think everyone has conversations about the deer lady in the woods who you have to watch out for, you know, or different superstitions like that, or, you know, talk of like Indian medicine or like, you know, someone being witched or something like that. You know, it's just like, that's daily conversation. And when you, and, you know, you hear these songs and it's just, you know, it's just a way of life. So you don't really have the perspective that you have isn't from the outside looking in on yourself. That's what I try. That's how I try to make films, is like, you know, all of my films, the ones before this weren't they were narrative feature films. And I try to tell those stories from the point of view of someone within inside of that community, not the outside looking back in on the community.
Art has been a part of your life since childhood. And when you went to college, you started out pursuing your interest in painting. And how did your film interest begin?
I went to the University of Oklahoma, which is like an hour and 15 minutes from my hometown. And it's, you know, it's a bigger town. It's still small, but it's a bigger town. It's a big college town. And I went there for painting school. And then eventually I took a film and video studies class, an intro to film and video studies. And that's really what got me interested in it and kind of like let me know that, made me realize that it could be a career. Like I could actually make films for a living. So that's when I switched my major and started. It was mainly a theory-based program. So I was just really studying film and writing about film.
When did you realize filmmaking was in your future?
I don't know. You know, like I remember telling people when I first got into film and started writing scripts, I remember telling friends, I was like, I'm going to write a script, man. I'm going to make a movie. And they were like, I don't know what you're doing. You know, they didn't really believe me. And I remember telling them, I was like, in 2 years, I will make a film. You know, I'm going to have a film made. And, you know, it took longer than that. It was 4 years, but I still did it. And so I think it was because I came from such a small town that I just felt like it was, you know, when I grew up in a small town, I was like, I would draw a picture and enter a contest and I'd win it. And it was like, you know, oh, this is easy. You know, I'm going to do that. And so whenever I started making films, I think that if I would have realized how many people out there are trying to make films, I probably wouldn't have done it. But because I kind of have this mentality of this small town person, it just doesn't feel like the world is that big. So, you know, going into it with filmmaking, it was just like, oh yeah, sure. I'm going to make films, you know, people are going to check them out and people are going to see them, you know? So it was never a thing that I worried about.
How has Sundance impacted you in your film career?
Sundance really changed my life. You know, like Bird Running Water from the Sundance Institute, who runs the Native Initiative, came to the University of Oklahoma while I was at school there. And someone just suggested I go listen to him speak. You know, I didn't know much about Sundance. I knew it was a film festival. I'd maybe heard about the Sundance Labs. And I went and heard him speak, and he was talking about the labs. And I was just like, that's what I need. That's what I got to do. And so it's weird because I never approach anyone like that. I never go up to anyone and talk to them. But I did with Bird, and I went and talked to him. And I said, I was like, hey, man, like, you know, I just want to introduce myself. Like, I really want to make films. And to Bird's credit, we went outside, he sat with me on a bench and just talked to me for like an hour about filmmaking and what I wanted to do. And at the end of it, he was just like, why don't you send me your script? And I'd just written a script. And so I sent it to him. I didn't get in with that script, but they liked it enough that they stayed in touch with me. And then I wrote another script and I got into the Sundance Labs. And, you know, it was just a validating thing. It was, you know, it was something that like this world-renowned organization recognizing my work, you know, out of 12, you know, out of like thousands of people applying, only 12 got picked and I was one of them. So, you know, it makes you feel pretty confident and good about yourself. And I remember I was roofing a house in Seminole, Oklahoma, and I was supposed to get a phone call by Sundance. They had told me the day before, somebody wrote me and said, they said that Michelle Satter from the Sundance program is going to call you at noon tomorrow. Can you be around your phone? And I was like, yeah. And so the next day I was roofing a house in Seminole, Oklahoma with these two like big bearded, redheaded biker guys. And they were brothers. And they were bikers, but they didn't have any motorcycles because their motorcycles had burned in a barn fire like the year before or something. So they just rode around in this little orange truck together. And they never could say my name right. I remember they would always call me Spence. And I just like, you know, I had to borrow a cell phone from my dad because I didn't even have a cell phone at the time. And so at lunch, I climbed off this roof. I went and sat in the car and ate a sandwich and waited on this phone call. And Michelle Satter and Lynn Auerbach from the Sundance Institute called and they said, you know, we want to invite you up to the Sundance Writers Lab. You know, you got in. And it was, you know, it was really amazing. It felt like this, you know, monumental moment in my life. And I thanked him and then I got off the phone and climbed back on the roof and, you know, tried to tell these guys what had just happened. And they had no idea what I was talking about. But so, you know, and from then I went to the labs and I got accepted to the director's lab and it really just changed my life. And it helped me be confident in what I do. I'd never worked with like a crew before until I went to Sundance. And it really just gave me the courage and, you know, helped me find a language in film that I can identify with. And it also made me more, you know, like coming from art school, I was pretty confident in just showing work and not caring about what people think. But Sundance really made me more confident in my work. And I was less precious about it. It's just like, get it out there and let people see it, you know.
Your latest film, This May Be the Last Time, it's a beautiful documentary. And it reveals that the blending of three cultures from the 1800s was the first true American music, I think. And it starts with a story about your grandfather's disappearance. And what inspired you to make this film about him and the Native church hymns?
Well, really, for me, the idea behind this film was the songs. I just had always been interested in these songs. I always wanted to make a film about these songs. In all of my previous films, I incorporate these songs. And it was just something that I'd always been interested in because I thought they were beautiful. And I realized that no one sang them and I didn't know where they were from or anything. You know, like I didn't know, like we just invented them or like, you know, no one else sings these songs in the world. So I was just always interested in them and I knew that they were beautiful and important. And so it was always in the back of my mind. And, you know, once we started shooting the film, the grandfather thing didn't happen until then. Like it wasn't until we were interviewing people. Like I had written a little intro and a closing that was gonna be a bookend to the film, a story about my grandpa, because I'd always heard this story about my grandpa when they looked for his body and they sang songs. And so, but once we started filming, I would mention that to people, and they would say, "Oh yeah, I was there. You know, I was there as a kid then." And like so, it just so happened that all these people that we were interviewing happened to be there. And so I just started talking. I'd turn the cameras back on, pull the cameras out of cases, and start interviewing them about my grandpa and that time that they were searching for him. And so that's really what happened. It just felt, you know, it was interesting because it felt like the story just needed to be told, and it was time for me to tell that story on film. You know, it was a story that I always heard my grandma tell and talk to her about it, but it, you know, I never thought about turning it into a story or filming it, but it was just time to do that, I think.
How long did it take to make?
We shot the film about 6 months, which is pretty, you know, short for some documentaries. But the thing was, is it's something that I'd been thinking about forever and collecting people that I wanted to interview over time. And really, it was a stroke of luck, too. We just got some amazing people on camera.
What was the process like making the film, and what did you discover along the way?
I never knew what I was going to do as far as the story of the songs, because, you know, it's such an abstract thing. And within, like, Native communities, like, we don't have history lessons about what we do. It's not like you sit down as a child and like, okay, this is where these songs come from and this is what they mean and blah, blah, blah. It's just the act of doing it, you know? That's a very indigenous thing, I feel like, is you do it. You just, like, it's a part of your culture. It's a part of your life. That's how you learn them, you know? But the key for me with these songs was I was showing my film Barking Water at RSU, and the man that brought me there was this tall redheaded guy, a white guy named Hugh Foley. He was a professor of music and different things, and he was talking to me. He'd brought me there. I just got through introducing the film, and we sat outside on the steps, and he was like, you know, I really think it's cool that you incorporate the Muskogee hymns into your movies. I was like, oh yeah, you know, I was like, you know, it's important for me. I want people to see how beautiful they are, Creek people, and see how beautiful and unique they are, and maybe they'll keep them alive longer or whatever. And he was like, yeah, you know, my favorite song is, and he started singing this song in Creek, and it kind of blew me away because I just didn't expect him to know one of these songs, you know. And so I started talking to him about it, and he told me this story of being adopted into this church kind of by marriage, and he was adopted in this church and just fell in love with the songs. And then he started talking about the history of these songs, and then that was kind of the key to the film for me, you know. It was like that opens up this other layer to the film that we need to make a story about these songs. But then once we started filming and people started talking to us, you know, they all opened up and it became even bigger. I feel like the film is everyone's, it's like different stories about these songs. So it's not like a linear film. It doesn't go from point A to point B. It's people's stories that are connected to these songs. And then the through line is my story connected to these songs. It's of my grandpa. And so, you know, it's a bunch of just different stories that happen to feel like one movie, you know. I'm sort of proud of the fact that it's different and interesting. One of my main collaborators on the film, Matt Leach, who produced and edited, you know, we talked a lot about, I mean, I remember like being at my house and not knowing what to do with the story. And it was before the grandpa stuff really came out to the front, before these people, I started talking to these people and they would happen to be from the communities. But I remember like throwing a frisbee with him outside and just trying to figure out the structure of the film, really. Because when we started, like, we just started with this idea of these songs, and, you know, I pitched it hard, you know. I said, you know, we can make an amazing film out of this. And then after we got the funding and the go-ahead to do it, it was like, oh no, like, hopefully we can make an interesting film out of this. So it was really just seeing what happened and being open to things that come at us whenever we're filming it. And that was the key to making it. I think if we would have went in really super structured with like everything, you know, it's going to be like this, I think that the film wouldn't have been as good, because that's not how these songs are treated and that's not how our stories are treated. So, and furthermore, like I'm a big part of the film, which I never really intended or wanted, but sometimes you have to let the story dictate where it goes and be open to things like that. And, you know, I come from a community where you're supposed to be very humble and not talk about yourself. So it was really, for me, it was really nerve-wracking to put myself, my voice on camera and my, you know, record my voice for the film. But I think the key to that was, it was a story about my grandpa that illustrated the power of these songs. So that really made things open up for me and made me okay with everything. I wish I sounded like Werner Herzog, but I don't.
In one scene of the film, you talk about change and how it is often seen as a negative in your community.
Because so much change was forced upon us. You know, we come from the Southeast, and that's where our homeland is, and that's where, you know, our religion took place. That's where we prayed to certain stars and constellations, and, you know, there were different things that meant different things to us, you know, within the natural world. And it wasn't the natural world in Oklahoma, it was the natural world in the Southeast where we had set up our homes. So, you know, when people violently remove you from your homeland and move you, That's change is looked at as negative. You know, it's a very negative thing because you're losing things when you change. So the communities that I'm from, they're very conservative in that way, that they don't want change. You know, it's like change is looked at as bad because, say you change these songs, you start putting music to these songs. Well, that's change, and you might lose what you used to have, you know. Or say that you say at our ceremonies, you know, like we have vendors. Well, then you're going to bring a lot of spectators in that aren't really there for the ceremonial side of it. And then it's going to change, and then it's going to never be the same again. So the communities that I'm from really try to hold on to what they have, and change isn't necessarily looked at as a good thing.
What songs in the film influence you the most, or are the most powerful to you?
One of my favorite songs is a song that a couple of the characters sing in the film, and it's called Momus Komagi Halawitaloven. It's about like not never giving up and, you know, things like that. But that's something that I'd known before. But one of the songs that really blew me away was and it's not in the film. The story's not in the film. Sometimes I wish it was, but it was just really hard to fit in the film. But this song is actually at the end credits of the film. And I have Wutko singing with these two sisters, the Brown sisters, and they're singing this song. But the story of this song is from the Trail of Tears. With the Muscogee Creek people, they brought the people in different groups. So sometimes families would be separated, or friends would be separated, or spouses and children would be separated. So a lot of our songs are about reuniting with our loved ones when we get to the new land, you know. And sometimes that's looked at as heaven, but it actually sometimes means when we get to the end of the Trail of Tears, we're going to be reunited with our family. One of these songs is just beautiful, and it's a song that one of the sisters had written. There were two sisters, and they were separated on the trail, and one of the sisters was up front in a group way towards the front, and she composed a song for her sister. It basically says, I will pray for you because I know that you will be praying for me wherever you are. And the people learned this song as she sang it, and they learned this song, and they kept learning it and pushing it down the Trail of Tears, basically. Different people would be picking it up and learning it until it reached her sister. And then her sister learned this song. And when they got to Oklahoma, they realized that the first sister had written this song, and they both knew this song together. And so it's a very touching song. It sounds kind of like a lullaby, and it's just really beautiful. And just that story behind it kind of illustrates everything that I think these songs represent.
Did it surprise you at all to find out how much the songs are connected to popular American music? I was really surprised to find out that one of the songs influenced the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, I mean, that blew me away, you know. It's like, but at the same time, it didn't blow me away because I know these songs are amazing. And we have another kind of songs, our ceremonial songs, which I would never make a film about because we're not allowed to, you know. It's one of those things that we don't want to get out, basically. Like, you don't want to get in the wrong hands and it change. But these songs are like, they influence the blues, you know. I mean, they are the blues when you hear them. And so, you know, I feel like in our community, we know that these songs are amazing. It's not too surprising that they have the influence that they have, you know. And obviously, it's something that's not talked about. So, but we're used to that. I feel like, you know, it's sort of, you know, in class, you read about Native history, and it's a page. Even in Oklahoma, it's just a page. Even though there's 38 tribes in Oklahoma, it's still just a page in the history book. So I think we're used to not having our culture be a part of the history of the country.
What do you think is the main source of courage the Native peoples have had to overcome such incredible and mostly unbearable circumstances and mistreatment? And how do you think other people can gain this courage to move forward?
You know, I mean, I just feel like Native people are really strong. And one thing that we've always done is we've held on to our humor. And I think that's really been a key element to pushing through some of the hardships is having a good sense of humor and staying true to like who we are as far as like people that have a certain ceremonial way of life about them. whether you're religious or not, the film's not a religious film, but it's about spirituality, and it's about singing songs to encourage yourself, and it's about the history of these songs and how they actually did help people survive. So for me, I mean, I feel like everyone can learn from that, no matter who you are. You know, everyone hits hard times, and everyone needs a way to get out of them. And these songs are an example of that.
Are works from Trudell and other great poets influential on the songs?
They don't influence these songs at all. You know, these songs come from the 1800s or before, so it's they don't change. You know, like, they've been written a long time ago. No one's writing, you know, there's not a lot of new songs that are being written, so they're sort of their own deal. Trudell, you know, I know him, and he's a friend of mine, but I wonder if he's ever heard these songs. I'll have to send him one.
What is your hope for the future of your community?
I hope for the future in the community that, you know, I would love for them to have an awareness of how unique they are and how beautiful some of these things are in their culture, and really celebrate them and keep them and preserve them and make an effort to learn them, you know, like make people, you know, encourage people to learn these songs and sing them, you know, and use them in their life because they're beautiful and it's what their ancestors did. And, you know, I just think that letting people know how unique they are is really helpful. And I feel like that's what I've done in all of my films, is really try to just highlight how unique the people that I come from are. And as far as the film goes, I'm not, you know, like, I've been nervous in the past at Sundance showing films there, you know, worried about reception or, you know, like, being nervous about it. But with this one, I'm not. It's just like, you know, if you don't feel it, then there's something wrong with you. So if someone doesn't like it, it's up to them. But I'm very happy with the film, and I think it strikes a sort of beautiful tone that I feel like people will get into. So I look forward to seeing it with people.
And what's next for you?
I actually have a feature film that I wrote that's pretty dark. Sort of a dark, it's like a thriller that takes place in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I'm shooting that in March, actually, which is just right around the corner. So that's crazy. And then, you know, hopefully after that, I don't know, I would like to make more money at this. So that would be a good thing. That's my goal in 2014.
We just have time for one more question. What would you like to tell listeners about? This may be the last time.
Check out the film. I think it's a film that people of any walk of life would be interested in and find appealing. So it'll probably be, you know, traveling around, and just hope people can check it out. Hopefully learn something from my community and these songs, and gain something from it in their life.
Thank you for listening. That was filmmaker Sterling Harjo.
SQ Radio is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Crumb Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Open Monday through Saturday until 3, offering daily soups, including clam chowder Friday on the last Friday of the month.
On From the Top, we don't just put young people on the show to hear their incredible musical performances. We celebrate the whole kid.
We're all members of the Vermont Astronomical Society, and we've also gotten really into building telescopes.
I run cross country, and I run track.
Well, I'll eat anything as long as it's not looking at me and as long as it's not moving around.
I believe the correct term is math stud.
Join me, Christopher O'Reilly, to meet America's most outstanding young musicians on From the Top, each week from NPR.
Friday afternoons at 2, repeated Sunday nights at 9 on Utah Public Radio.